Actually, I'm not too big on torture, preferring the euphoric touch, where the string's end gets tied to a toothache and bells spit out a bloody yippee whenever you sneak out and slam the door. In the empty bowl of a has-been, in the sticky distance of a drowning fly, swims toward that lone cheerio. In a wink, tossed across a crowded party and demolishing the polite wall of chatter, here on the lush west coast, where passion's a crime against nature, you stuck your tongue out and I felt infinity filling my ear like rock and roll.
That was Andrei Kudrevsky reading from Jeffrey Miller's book of poems entitled The Heart is a Quarter Pounder. Hi, I'm Pat Nolan, and this is a special edition of A Novel Idea. Rosemary will be back next month with a new program. Jeffrey Miller was the original punk poet. He was a flinty-eyed poet with spiky blonde hair and a wicked smirk. There was something special about him, and his poetry captured the kind of rock and roll fever that infected everyone in those days. It was incredibly hip, angry, pop, like Iggy Pop, witty, insightful, sardonic, sarcastic, irreverent, even surreal, and it seethed with savage energy. So in the spring of this year, I met with Andre in Berkeley at a friend's house, and we discussed the publication of Jeffrey's book and published posthumously by a publishing house in Boulder, Colorado, Farfalla Press. We thought it might be a nice idea to do a tribute to Jeffrey on or near the date of his death, which was July 29th, 1977. So 28 years later, it would be great if we could recreate that evening in one sense by bringing his spirit back through his poetry. This evening, we'll be hearing excerpts from the reading at the Pegasus Theater on the evening of July 29th. The authors who are reading are Andrei Kudrevsky, myself, Gail King, Lana Mihalesko, Joanne Kiger, and Mike Tuggle, Jerry Rosen, and David Bromwich. The evening begins with a conversation between myself and Andre about those days in 1975 when Jeffrey lived among us.
Well, it only took 28 years for a good, beautiful edition of Jeffrey Miller's poetry to be published. Jeffrey Miller was a 29-year-old poet who was born and died on the 29th of July, which is tonight. So all those numbers are amazing because they accumulate like that. I didn't play the lottery today, but they'll probably come up. 28 years, and the book is here, which means that if you're a writer or an artist, the main thing is to have friends. Because then it really doesn't matter how long it takes, your poems will come out and people will celebrate them and they will read them. And it really doesn't matter if you're alive or dead. Well, it matters to you, maybe. Although I don't see why it should. So Jeffrey's gone, we're still here, his friends from a long time ago, and the book is here. And the book is wonderful, it's called The Heart is a Quarter Pounder, which is was Jeffrey's chosen title, I think, for a collection. The first book we made was called The First One's Free, but The Heart is a Quarter Pounder is definitely a Jeffrey Miller title, and so much so that we actually wrote it in wet cement in San Francisco in front of this place I had on Lappage Street. And it's still there. So if you don't get the book tonight, just go over there and check it out. Read through the cement. So I was living here, I think, for 2 years. I moved to the river in 1973. I came to visit Pat Nolan, Pat and Gail, actually, and fell in love with this place, which was so wonderfully not San Francisco. Then moved here in 1973. And Jeffrey showed up some 2 years later. There is some debate about this. Pat and I talked back and forth about it because I can't quite remember when exactly I met Jeffrey, but suddenly he showed up, and he was this sort of mass of unkempt poetic genius with, with some idea that you could live as a poet forever. And he did. And so did we at the time. We became very good friends. I always had this feeling that he was a great poet, but I really didn't know how great he was, because when you are part of a scene and there are poets around and they're showing you their poems, I think living poets, writers' first impulse when they read their friends' poems is to have just a slight resistance to them and think immediately, I think I can do better than this. My poems are better than this. But, I mean, I always had a great deal of respect for Jeffrey's poetry. And when he died and I was faced with some of the amazing quantity of posthumous works that he left behind, I was amazed at how great he really was. And something else became evident, which is that a lot of his poems seemed already written from the other side, as if he knew something that at the time none of us did. For that reason, and many others having to do with the poetry itself, his poems have stayed amazingly contemporary, and Jeffrey himself has seduced many, many young writers who never met him, including the publishers of this book who are here tonight, Gary and Colin, who did an incredibly amazing job of putting this book together. So I think from now on I am going to have a little conversation with Pat, who has more memory than I do. Maybe we can work out exactly the details and time of Jeffrey's arrival here, and then it's Pat Nolan.
Thank you. I just had a memory upgrade, 1 gigabyte of RAM, so I think I'm good for tonight. Andre had come up to the river looking for nude beaches. He hadn't found any, so he remembered my address out of the blue, which is one of those things. And so when my wife walked in and Andre was sitting at my desk reading my mail.
So anyways, I didn't get it off of my own.
That's true. And of course, when I saw him, he said, yes, nice letter from Lewis Warsh. So we formed a fast friendship, and we both have a smattering of French, so we engaged in some translations of the French poets.
We translated them all.
Yes, we did. We did. We even translated John Ashbery, even though he didn't need it. In the fall of 75, I went to my post office box when the post office was still in Monterio proper. Now it's Monterio improper. And there were bills, and there were rejection slips, and then there was this fat envelope. And in that envelope were some astounding poems by Jeffrey. He was riffing off the same melodies, the same music that we were hearing coming out of New York, but of course all those New York poets had moved to Bolinas or to the West Coast, and now they were transplanted.
Well, that helped a lot, Pat.
But I have...
We went to the post office a lot, Jeffrey.
Yes, we did. And we spent a lot of time at the Naughty Room. I don't know if you know about the Naughty Room. It's not there anymore. It burned down.
Yeah. Rhonda, yes.
And we would sit at the counter and drink coffee and read Andre's mail. He got mail. I didn't. And if you're an author or a writer, you know how important mail is. Now it's email. But anyways, I was really struck by Jeffrey's poems, and I wrote back immediately. And this is a facsimile or a reconstruction of that letter. Dear Jeff Miller, thanks for letting me see your terrific poems. And for the 2 quarters that dropped out of the envelope and bounced across the floor of the post office lobby. I assume they're for return postage. That's very thoughtful of you. And they paid for my cup of coffee at the Naughty Room, where I read your poems at my leisure. They are flippant, arrogant, full of bombast and bravado, and a vitality that makes the connections actually spark. Please thank David Bromage for suggesting that you send your work my way, and if you ever get out to Monterio, please stop by. The Romanian poet Andrei Codrescu just moved up here from San Francisco, and he also liked your poems. He was sitting next to me in the Naughty Room when I read them. Maybe I can use a couple of them in the next issue of my magazine, The End, which Andre will be helping me edit. We're also putting together a little reading series at a cafe near here called Stone Soup, at which I'm sure you'll be welcome to read. Anyways, thanks for the poems and the cup of coffee.
Yeah, The End was a great magazine, Pat. It's a collector's item now. It's one of the great mimeographs of the day. And Pat was a very severe editor, very stern, as you can tell at the beginning of that. And actually, I didn't remember any of that. I remember that Jeffrey sort of showed up, and he had my first book of poems, License to Carry a Gun, and he said, "These are totally great." So I liked that. And I thought I introduced him to you, but as it turns out, the chronology is off. I was just going to read one of Jeffrey's poems called Jeremy, and it goes something like this. "Jeremy, it must be honky-dory on Venus. The synapse, an anticipated snap where your lover's tongue goes bananas and clears out space like a broke rubber band. No more headaches. Cluck, cluck. Cluck. Let's toast eternal imagination with pink gin and stuff up the bud's homemade holes with whatever's handy. Insects are evil thoughts, Lou Reed. The poetry of Earth is never dead, Keats. And Jeremy, where are you? All these scams seem orphaned." I mean, it was funny because when you talk to him about this, he'd always sort of say, "Well, where is Jeremy?" But then he wrote this poem, which actually was quite moving. And much later, last year I wrote a poem, and I've forgotten really about Jeffrey's poem, and it's called Greetings They Weren't Using Then. "I walked past Jeremy in the park. 'What's up, Jay?' I said, having last seen him on Castro Street circa 1976, following some guy, quote, 'Too busy to talk right now, I'm following some guy. I had sex all night, it wasn't enough,' unquote. This time he was imaginary, teaching cruising altitude," he said. "Cruising, he was always cruising. Cruised to Venus, according to Jeff, who kept track of the disappeared. He joined them not long after. And that is a form. The last time I saw so-and-so, form we are becoming all too adept at practicing these days. All I wanted to say was chartreuse, about being alone or something, or cinnamon, or how I met somebody at Ochre in Maine, but Jeremy showed up. 'What's up? What's up? What's up? What's up?' Greetings they weren't using then." So, yeah, I mean, we continue the conversation.
When Andre and I talked about doing this thing, it was kind of a casual conversation at a friend's house in Berkeley. Yeah, we should do something nice for Jeffrey, the book's coming out. And we wanted to bring old friends of Jeffrey's on stage. When we were all together and young and crazy and doing all those young and crazy things, you need a muse for inspiration. And sometimes a person comes along and inspires you just by their presence, by their enthusiasm. And so the next person is a friend of ours from those days, a talented writer in her own right, the fabulous, the mercurial Lana Mihelescu.
Hi, everybody. It was really a wonderful, exciting time. You could always count on going to visiting Pat and Gil, and there would always be somebody new to be found at their home that was just night's entertainment. And of course, you know, I didn't take much for me to get excited and enthusiastic about what was ever happening. So I'll always hold that time as a great part of my own personal history. My memory of Jeffrey was somewhat brief. However, I always, you know, just like all of us, we always heard about the shenanigans, and there were lots of shenanigans. He always reminded me kind of a cross between the punk of James Dean and the look of Kurt Cobain, you know, and kind of a little bit of the old and the new. But anyway, I have two that I picked here, and the first one is called Bathing Alone. "A taxi pulls up with your name splashed on it. I grab a ride to the Golden Gate Bridge, no hockey puck, not to jump. I want to ask the incessant sandblasters how they feel about something that's both essential and bound to disappear. They shake their heads at me the same way I shake my head when you go away. You go away like soap bubbles from my goofy mouth. My toy book gets sucked down the drain, and I return to the problem spot in the middle of my back. And the other one is Hell's Angels. Obviously, drowning and dying of thirst are the same thing. In each, you're born in a plush room where water provides the only light. I've seen the angels, and their sunglasses are mirrored tears. Thank you. And I just, in closing, I just want to, you're listening, Ti amo Jeffrey, buon viaggio sempre.
Thank you, Lana. Jeffrey's poems are indeed wonderful and surprising, and every time I read them, I'm always struck by how deep his sense of poetry was. It probably went as deep as in the Western tradition to Orpheus. He was an inspired poet. When you read the poems, somebody else reads those poems, that spirit comes out. Now, please welcome Gail King.
Actually, I've been wanting to bring someone else to the party who can't come. As Jeffrey became a legend for those of us who knew him, there was someone amongst us that was a legend, a living legend, Hans Volker, who many of you maybe have never heard of him. He was an incredible scholar of Hart Crane. And as such, he carried Hart Crane with him at all times. He named his dog in regard to Hart Crane. He built his house in regard to Hart Crane. And I think that Andre has carried Jeffrey, not in the same way. He hasn't built his house in the Jeffrey Miller way, but he's carried Jeffrey around and has made this happen. And it's great to have that happen for Jeffrey. And the only way to bring Hans to the party is to read the poem he would have always read first, any time he read. And I need my glasses. The nights move, the drifting foam of oceans move, and the movement, the voyages of nights and foams are unbridged circles, endlessly in movement, endlessly in search. Moons set, suns rise and set, and new moons rise and fall forgotten with remembered stars, with new suns slowly of the morning, from the ocean to the city endlessly. And one must question this, the contradictions of the sun and moon, of darkness and of light, for they are voyages of timelessness. We walk, for we are moments cast upon the timeless beach, which merges with the sea, which merges with the sky. And then there is soft rain, and suddenly a dragon swallows us. But we have danced and written parts of poems, and this lives, added to and changed, corrected and revised endlessly. It passes under moon and sun and moon in timeless wave, from pen to pen, from consciousness to consciousness of poets. It lives and changes with the consciousness of tides, and although the poets die, one walks with them and is with them, and often then these things are true. I know, and inexplicable. The poem does not, and to the veritable poet is the poem, undead, transmembered by the single change of laughter, which is no longer heard, and Cuddy Sark, which is no longer drunk. The myth is sucked by voyagers. Jeffrey peopled his poetry, and a lot of us, I think of myself, I take photography, and in doing such, I take a lot of nature photography. I've got endless pictures of beautiful mountains and trees, and I often forget to take pictures of the people. And Jeffrey, as a poet, always had people in his poems, so it's full of people. And I think that that's something that makes it makes his world come to life. Anyway, so this is a poem called A Sucky Dream. for Gail about Michael. Actually, it's a prose poem. The dream begins when I wake up. Someone calls on the phone to tell me Groovy's dead. Groovy, hardly knew him. But how can he groove if he's dead? I can't figure it out. I pick up Andre and we drive to the city. We eat some hash cookies. I tell him about Groovy. We talk about politics. Everything is very confusing. I suspect that a wheel might fall off the car, but I suspect there's no reason to mention it to Andre. I tell him to read Gail's poems, which are in my bag. He reads a poem and holds it up in his hand, about to comment. A gust of wind catches it and sucks it, with a whoosh, out the window. I look in the mirror and see it being blown and battered by all the cars and trucks. We both laugh hysterically, shaking our heads, feeling alive and terrible. I dump Andre at a bar and go to college, where I read a short story to my class. They're all awed by it and at a loss for their usual stupid, petty remarks. I know that it's just a successful camouflage sketch, but I'm feeling quite smug when Bruce picks me up. Bruce tells me that Michael's dead. He died in his sleep. Just what in hell is going on? I'm incredibly hungry. Whenever my friends die, I eat enough for two people. I decide to devote a minute of my precious time to Michael. I talk to myself. I say, I. As I get a little drunk, I start screaming, Michael, not out the window. I try to think of a word dirty enough to fill the obscene hole people dig when they die. What we have left are the survivors. And I, for one, feel so alive that I'm afraid to sleep again. I think I'll do the Dayglow question of identity. I summon something when nothing works except my heart, which always trudges on like a paperboy peddling wares through the snow and dogs. The Detroit News won't even give you your birthday off. I practice stare downs with myself and win. I win. The real me jumps out of my face, bounces back, and finally ends up sleeping in my lap, like the private eye who just stumped himself with his own questions. A master of the surreal chain smoking. Whenever I consider suicide, I whistle and I giggle. When horrified by the life I see spread out on both sides of my eyes, thanks, lucky stars, for these girls, these charmers, and the guy I call Jeffrey Miller. They keep me enthralled banging around in here, a riot among friends. I had to dig this one out of the old, old pile, the typewriter-written poetry, because this was written 2 months after Jeffrey was killed. It's also 1 month... Well, actually, it's really interesting because Jeffrey died on the 29th and Elvis Presley died 15 or 16 days later. And I went, Jeffrey and now Elvis? And I remember the impact of that. These were the Carter years, you know. Ford and Carter, and if you think about what the youth was doing during the Ford and Carter years, Vietnam had just ended, Squeaky Fromm pointed a gun at, you know, Gerald Ford, on and on. Sin Q and the SLA was busy. So this is called The Poem Research for Jeff Miller, 2 months too late, written by myself. Maxwell Parrish did our sky tonight at sunset. We walk after dishes, scared by some corn patch. Nice visit to Huntsie's yesterday. We pick up our pound from the poet's patch. Tonight late I sit, Thelonious Monk signs off. He's got it easy. I can do that one. My piano's out of tune anyway. Want to set free, just ramble? We'll need to unload. It's all right that his heart was torn out by a tree at who knows what speed, the speed of death. It's okay. There were movies made. There were movies missed. None of us catch it all. It mystifies me how sacred they've become. Like Frank O'Hara said, he had a sense for life, as though living, as though dying. I forget that vital awareness most of the time, as though living, as though life were less, were just the pits. Forget it. Each precious moment captured, not forgetting, not to miss that what one would keep. I do, and so I love parties. Just invite me around, and I'll stay. I would have caught more, but But who knew last spring, last summer, when we swam for the one and only time in Austin Creek this year? The creek's gone, you know, down, way down past the monument, the crazy monument where I'd never been. I'll have to go there again sometime, though it might kill me. I would take us back. Frank said, I only need one bullet, preferably silver. If you can't be interesting, at least you can be a legend. Frank and Jeff died 11 years apart in July of 66 and 77. We've got to go on living to remember the Windex, the rosebuds, hunting up a match that blows out. With this waning moon, the temperatures drop, the air is moist. To what god have we sacrificed? For lives to change, we must sacrifice all. Let it go. Find yourself again in another 20 or 40 and remembering. It's a 20th century gimmick to die young. It never fails to work. The great events go unnoticed. Thank you.
I'm Pat Nolan. You've been listening to A Novel Idea on KRCB. We're going to take a short break now. Hi, I'm Pat Nolan, and welcome back to A Novel Idea. In the studio tonight is Suzanne Lang, the producer of A Novel Idea, and she had an opportunity to talk with Andre, my good friend Andre Kudrescu.
It was a pleasure to meet him. I've heard you talk about Andre for years and years, and so it was a pleasure for me to make his acquaintance as well, Pat.
Yes, and he's an interesting character. After all these years, he still hasn't lost his accent. I think that's his stock in trade. It's kind of like the Beatles, you know. They were cute because they had an accent.
It had me under its spell.
Yes. Well, he does have that kind of Svengali look about him anyways, you know. It's just, it must be an Eastern European thing.
I think so. But it was a great conversation I was able to have with him. I began by asking him about the scene on the river, about the Russian River poets, and about your relationship with each other and with Jeffrey Miller.
And yeah, we did have a scene. I mean, clearly there was some kind of sharing through and a kind of a battle of egos, because poets being poets, they always want to write a better poem than everybody else. And so the bar was set pretty high. And on the one hand, you had Pat Nolan writing the sort of Japanese works, who Pat's work being closer in spirit and in form to that of Gary Snyder or Joanne Kiger or Philip Whalen, those California Zen poets. Keith Abbott was also a good friend of Pat's. Pat was probably Monterio's great laureate, poet laureate, because Pat's poetry paid very close attention to nature, to those big trees and the water and the sound of things and on the river and the moods of the river and so on. Jeffrey was finding his way. His influences were New York School poets like Frank O'Hara. He loved Ted Berrigan's poetry, although he never met Ted. He has a poem in there dedicated to Ted Berrigan. Berrigan himself died in 1983 on July 4th, so they never met. So those are his influences. He was also interested in the kind of metaphorical European surrealism that I brought with me from where I came from, very far away in Romania, Transylvania. So we were all doing our own thing. Hans Volker, of course, was influenced by Hart Crane and was creating his own opus around the bridge, kind of a gigantic poetic footnote to Hart Crane's great poem, The Bridge. And so there was, you know, in addition to the idea of having each of us read and share our poems and compete in a kind of a pure lyric sense, we also represented different kinds of aesthetics. And so our conversations had a great deal to do with the poets we liked and the traditions that we thought we belonged to. And so it was rich because it wasn't just about reading a few lines of verse on a page. It was about where we came from and what that meant. And in a time when everything in America was terribly unsettled, the social body was unsettled, the politics of the place was completely crazy. I mean, California was an insane place. At that time of the sort of cultural upheaval, it seemed urgent. It seemed very important for us to try and figure out where we were at and what we were doing and why this scribbling of verse was important and why it was okay to live like bohemians on the Russian River instead of working at 9-to-5 jobs somewhere in the city and being good citizens. And so all of that, the politics of the day and the culture that we each represented turned out to be, in retrospect, very significant. At the time, a lot of it from the outside might have looked like just one big drunken party with people arguing and smoking an awful lot of pot and registering emotions on the Richter scale constantly, you know, up and down about each other and all of that. Although at the time, I'm not sure we knew it. I mean, I'm not sure that either Pat or I knew what a great poet Jeffrey was. I think we certainly thought that he was somebody interesting and somebody whose poems we read with some degree of amazement, but we didn't quite know what an incredible creature landed in Monterio. We thought about it after he died, of course, and the eeriness of his work, the beauty of it, and the depth of his humor actually startled us, I think. What it was about Jeffrey's poetry is that it really had a kind of hidden time device that only went off after he died. Many of his poems seem written by someone who's already dead. They have this very oddly disembodied quality and yet a friendly one, somebody who's very near but disembodied in some sense. That's a quality that's not possible to read when somebody's actually in person next to you being goofy. But it's sort of clucked in the poems after he died.
You must have gone through a process that at some point culminated in The Heart is a Quarter Pounder. But maybe we could start with The First One's Free.
Well, The First One's Free is a book that for all practical purposes doesn't exist, partly because it was free. And the book was published with Mary Hyson's money. Mary had a philosophy at the time, as did all the commune people around her, called free. Everything had to be free. Of course, Mary paid for it, so it was not quite free, but she wanted the book to be given away. And so about 1,000 copies were printed, and they disappeared immediately. This is one of the extremely rare copies. And so Jeffrey's first book of posthumous poems appeared a year after he died, and it was edited in the end by Jim Gustafson, another great poet who's no longer with us. For years, I tried to find the publisher to reprint The First One's Free and add some more of the posthumous works, which are totally great, and there are still some that are not in here. Finally, the Boulder Farfalla Press, Tyler Birnbaum, read the poems, and this was a whole other generation of poets. Now, about two or three generations had read The First One's Free and thought of it as a myth. Jeffrey was, for poets, he was a sort of Kurt Cobain or some young genius or Rambo or John Keats who more things were known about than actually read. I mean, people knew that he had this bright star that burned very quickly. And Tyler and his friends were suitably amazed by the freshness and the contemporary voice in these poems. They agreed to publish the book. So I kept after them and looked after every detail, really, of cover and type. And we proofread it 900 times because Jeffrey himself wasn't a very good speller. And sometimes there were conflicts between his margin notes, which he'd written on the on his poems, he changed his mind about various things, and inevitably his first version was usually better than his rethinking of it. So there are decisions of that kind to be made. And editing these poems was like having a conversation with Jeffrey. It was like arguing about every version of the poems, and we did it when he was alive 37 years ago, and we still do it, because of all my dead friends, this one is the most alive somehow. I sense the dead pretty well, and Jeffrey definitely has a presence that is very vivid. He was a practical joker of some kind. He had a certain very peculiar sense of humor, so I hear him now and then. And when I was editing these poems, I was both careful and tough, because I didn't want to give in to what I thought Jeffrey might have liked, because I have no idea whether he might what he might or might not, or whether this is all in my head or not. So I did what I thought was right, but mostly that consisted of disregarding his own later thinking about his poems. He was still young, and he himself wasn't too sure after he'd written something whether it was the best thing or not. And he was influenced easily by reading and by people, and so he looked again at his poems after a while, and probably brought to them some kind of more jaded critical apparatus, and he thought that he could fix them, not realizing that they were completely terrific in the first place. There was nothing to fix.
It seems that his death had quite an impact on everybody around him. His life and death permeated people's work. In your introduction to The Heart is a Quarter Pounder, you make it sound that that was a real point of departure in your own life.
Jeffrey's death was the end of a certain period for me. Mainly the Russian River era age came to an end. I went back east and realized that there actually was a place where people got up in the morning and went to work, which didn't occur to me in California for about 10 years or so. And it was a good change. It was quite bracing. I wouldn't say that it was the onset of wisdom of any kind, but certainly it changed my life. I mean, I thought back about the extraordinary freedom that I had and the leisure that I had to develop my art and to have friends like Jeffrey in town, people like Pat Nolan around to talk about my works with. So it was my long, prolonged adolescence. So, it was a charmed time and in its own time capsule, and Jeffrey's death certainly marked it. It was also a very highly symbolic and poetic death, because he died on his birthday, which is July 29th, his birth-death date, as Bruce Cheney calls it. He died in a car accident hitting a tree on the curve just out of Monterio going to Duncan Mills. And he'd been involved with trees his entire life. He cut. He was a tree cutter back in Maine. He learned how to do that. And when he came to California, he was scared of the redwoods. He looked at them and he said, well, these trees, one of their branches is as big as one of the trees back in Maine. So he had some kind of awesome feeling about these very giant beings, one of which ended up killing him. He was almost 30 years old. He was 29 when he died. So he told everyone that he was 30. He lied. He said, in fact, he wrote a poem in there for my 30th birthday, and in fact, he was 29. But it seemed to him very symbolic. It was a big passage. And he himself had some idea about taking a very different direction in his life at that point. And the afternoon of his death, we talked quite a bit about how and what he was going to do. I mean, he wanted to leave and go somewhere else, and he had plans. He died in the accident in the night, and his funeral ceremony brought together that entire community. So there were people I hadn't seen in a long time, even on the river, who came to near Jenner by the Sea, where we threw his ashes into the ocean on a very windy day. All of that went, you know, in the ocean, and that was the end of that. So everything was marked very symbolically and very definitely by Jeffrey's death. Jeffrey was a young man when he died, and his poems are young. Young people fall in love constantly with his poems, people who didn't know about him or didn't know him, certainly didn't know his work. Hopefully some kind of another spontaneous combustion will happen about Jeffrey's poetry. But on the other hand, I just look forward to it, seeing the people I haven't seen in a long time.
Yes, and that's what this program's all about. It is about the poetry of Jeffrey Miller, who was an amazing talent, as the excerpts from the event show. It's, in a sense, looking back at it, it was a rather electrifying performance by everyone who were able to serve as the mouthpiece for this incredible poetry.
It really was an electric evening, and we're going to get back to it in a minute with more excerpts from that evening. One of the highlights was David Bromwich getting on stage, because he's not well, and that he came out for the event and did such a fabulous reading was amazing.
He did. He was probably the most able interpreter of those particular poems.
That evening was quite an event, quite a reunion.
It was. It brought together a lot of friends that had not been together on the same stage or even in the same square mile in many years. And it was very nice for the folks who participated, and I think that the audience appreciated it as well.
The audience was really into it.
There was something special about the evening, too. The fact that it was held on the 29th, on the anniversary of his death, and the fact that his poetry is so incredible that things just fell into place. It was a very magic evening, and even though I hesitate to use those kind of words, it was very very special.
And before we get back to listening to a little bit more of that evening, maybe you could embellish the descriptions of Jeffrey a little bit. It seems like Lana likened him to James Dean and Kurt Cobain. He's being portrayed as somebody who had a punk quality to him.
Well, Jeffrey was the original punk poet. Unfortunately, as soon as he earned that title, he died. But he was grunge before Seattle even had a clue. And, you know, if we want to make an analogy, if Charles Bukowski was John Wesley Harden, then Jeffrey was Billy the Kid.
Let's get back and listen to some of those excerpts.
When Andre asked me to scare up some talent, I thought, who, you know, in my mind, who's one of the great poets that I admire and that I would like to see up here reading Jeffrey's poems? And she's a great friend and a great poet. Please welcome the grand dame of American poetry, Joanne Kiger.
Thank you so much. When I was first moved to Bolinas in the late 60s, when I heard that there was something called the Russian River Poets, my heart beat really wildly, because I thought we can always go north with all the attendant difficulties of septic tanks, watersheds, deer, you know, just everything that went on, that there was no way to explain where the subject of writings shifted to. Jeffrey, I ran into in the middle of Bolinas one day, in front of the Bolinas Market, and I thought, oh, wow, this is so wonderful to see this great young man from the Russian River Poets, as we were having our Bolinas Poets. I just marked up a few pieces of his to read. You've got to know where you're going. If you don't know where you're going, how will you know when you get there? What if you took off for the office and ended up on Skid Row? What if you asked me for a drag and I broke your jaw? Please make plans. Please don't trust the moss on trees. Remember to keep your lips moist on blind dates. If you get down to $2.39, buy white port. Realize the difference between good and bad information. I hope you know how tender this all is. You know, my bones and my yawns are completely tender. I keep trying to round off my poems, but I just can't. Maybe it's because I'm too short to think that way. Who knows? Who knows about anything? About me, about you, about the junk in the middle. Forget about whispering in the stream of a plane crash. I hope I never write poems with boring egos. I hope to shout on the edge of delirium that my private foot keeps a beat going and reminds you and you that we miss the dead because they were in on it. And we miss the flag of their laundry flying away. And when it rains, we miss their wet melancholy. I hope the transition doesn't leave any grease. I don't want any punk creases on my white silk. It seems clear to me that things are flipping, and secretly I plan on becoming an angel. Now that wish has clawed out of the bag. I hope you notice that the cat can't tell time. Hopefully the vanguard of yesterday won't stab you in the back. And it is essential that you comprehend all of this with a smile. Weather tag. You're it. The gods touch you. Clouds scooped out by bored angels who know truth doesn't matter, but touch you with sweetness just the same. Let's hear it with a dedication in rain. It keeps falling with total disregard. How about that? Splashing apart, heartbroken, coming back for more, washing a chocolate double dipper off the face of a little nipper, adding dimension to the pale pink laundromats and going st-st on streetlights. St-st. I'm scared silly, wanting to be nudged beyond hallucination and wanting to fill the space I save between my hands with something that won't eat me. The cliché of blood reincarnates and tinkles tiny bells as it falls over my bones and my fingers like soggy matches. I'm more busy than the weatherman today, welding a camouflage to the body of escape. It's all so true, everything he says, you know, just... And this is from a request from Bill Bergson, who is down in with the Bolinas poets. Well, the Russian poets were up here with their river... Electricity. Distance crackles. At one point, it overloads measurement. Sometimes this is touch. Commonly glancing across a street must do. I don't want your underwear. What I want is a speck of your undivided attention, the lovely shock of being together.
I'm not disappointed. I know Jeffrey would be incredibly jealous of the way Joanne read his beautiful poems. What I'd like to do now is bring up two folks who were professors at Sonoma State when Jeffrey attended there. Jeffrey came from back east, and Bruce can correct me on this, was finishing up his bachelor's at Sonoma State and then was going on to San Francisco State to get his master's. And one of these folks is the one who sent Jeffrey my way, and the other one is my old novel professor, Jerry Rosen. They both have tales to tell, so we're going to invite them up here, Jerry and David. And we know David is the past poet laureate of Sonoma County, but he's a major figure in Sonoma County poetry. Anybody who's gone to Sonoma State and taken classes in poetry has been under the tutelage of Herr Bromage. Welcome, Ben.
I thought I would read these two poems, which no one yet has read tonight. Lucky me, blasted on good grass, alone in my house, which has electricity. and with Steely Dan on the hi-fi, a good band. Right now, my baby's coming down Highway 116 in a car with no muffler and one headlight, listening to a scratchy radio. She's just got off work selling burgers, so her pocket's full of beautiful quarters. I think I'll have some bourbon and anxiously await her return. And the other one, also taken from his first book, the first one's free. Were you ever driving at 3 a.m. down some two-lane road in upstate New York, and it was raining, and the only radio station you can get is from Memphis or someplace, which comes in perfectly and sounds great, like life could be a dream, doo-wop, doo-wop, and you just turn them up and say to yourself, what the f***? What the f***? Well, that's how I feel walking from the Monterio post office. Thank you. My friend Jerry Rosen, we talked about some things he could say, but if I know Jerry, and I've known him now for 70 years or so, he's not going to say it. He's going to do something else. But I'll get out of your way so you can get to the mic.
Thank you, David Bromage. I don't think poetry in Sonoma County would be recognizable without David over the years. He's really been, I think, the center of writing in Sonoma County. I was teaching a class at Sonoma State when I met Jeffrey Miller. He showed up at the class. Jeffrey was immensely likable. He was sort of a likable rapscallion. To my mind, meeting Jeffrey, it was like meeting Arthur Rimbaud and Huckleberry Finn on the same raft. And I just want to share one image of his that I've remembered for 30 years, which I think says something about him. This was a time when Patty Hearst had been kidnapped, the heir to the Hearst newspapers, the heiress, and she was held by the SLA, and then she joined her abductors and held up a bank. And there was a famous photo of her for weeks in the paper with an automatic weapon holding up the bank and looking into the bank security camera. And so Jeffrey is in class, and then he suddenly says, Patty Hearst, her inky black newspaper eyes. And I thought, whoa, hello, you know, that is very interesting. And so I was very impressed by Jeffrey at that time, and I can always see his mischievous smile. And I just wanted to say two sentences from a book I've been writing, because strangely, I was writing about Jeffrey when I heard about this event, and I determined to come up from the city, and it's called The Loneliness of Not Suffering. And the subtitle is A Novelist's Search for Meaning. And there's two sentences I just want to read from this book that strike me as being in the spirit of Jeffrey, with somewhat of his mix of seriousness, humor, and always rebelliousness. In the 60s, an entire generation went crazy, wouldn't listen to reason, turned to violence, and almost wrecked our nation. That was the adults. The second one is more serious, I guess, and it says, some of the most esteemed novelists of our day, writers like Philip Roth, Joyce Carol Oates, Jonathan Franzen, are excellent at depicting the grim prison of our culture, but they seem to have forgotten the lesson that was taught to us by Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, that a book can do more than map the jail. It can offer us a plan of escape. Thank you.
Hey, don't forget David.
Please welcome Mike Tuggle.
Apartment 8. I want to scream, sometimes I know so much about baseball, rock and roll, junk like that. I know I'll clean my apartment before I die. Sometimes while polishing a spoon, a voice says, scream. This scream is followed by a huge thump from above, like God's having a heart attack, or like apartment 7 is saying, keep it down. There are certain manners involved in everything, even in a slum. And this crime intrinsic to suicide is like chop suey on my religiously spotless kitchen, even in a slum. One more small one here. My bottle opener is MIA. My bottle opener is MIA, and I'm searching. The beer is lined up on the table, and it's not American beer, which can be opened with a soft American twist. No, this is Mexican beer in thick brown bottles. If a horse smashed a GI in the face with one of these, blood would splash out. Maybe his eye would hang. He could show his grandkids the scar and say, get me a beer. If it was American beer, the kid could open the bottle. But this is Mexican beer, and I'm in my kitchen, a jungle, searching, because you need an opener for these babies. They're like hand grenades without a pin to pull, and I'm no pacifist. I'm just on my own side.
That wraps up this evening of A Novel Idea. Thanks to Suzanne Lang for her producing this show and actually helping produce the event that occurred back in July.
And I want to thank all the poets who read that evening in July on the Russian River at the Pegasus Theater for their generosity of time and spirit and the breath that they gave to the works of Jeffrey Miller. And I can't let the evening escape without acknowledging and thanking Andre Kudrescu, your longtime friend and cohort. And, of course, we know him from his commentaries on NPR and his many books and works. His tireless energy is what saw to the publication of Jeffrey Miller's book, The Heart is a Quarter Pounder. And Andre wrote the foreword to that book. And it's available from Farfalla Press out of Boulder, Colorado. You can order it directly at www.farfallapress.net. And finally, I want to thank you, Pat Nolan, for hosting this edition of A Novel Idea.
Now, Rosemary Manchester will be back next month. So thanks for listening in. Thanks to Suzanne and to the engineer, Katie Stolman. I'm Pat Nolan. Thank you.